Okay, so it's 8:15. I just like to show you that this is also a way of getting into the Vorlesung of this year. And Robin has to tell us there is only one of these options that actually has the subtitles. Which is this one? This one?
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that takes too long. Ach nee, jetzt kommt Flash Play. And so what I'd like to do is to repeat what we have done last time with the movie. So we remind ourselves what we have discussed last time. So we had constructed a sample with three different spins, and the different spins are represented by three different vectors, and the vector length represents the number of equivalent protons, and after a pulse, after a pulse applied along the a transverse direction, for example x, the magnetization rotates in the zy plane, stops along y, and now we had generated a vector that is orthogonal to the static bz field, and the effect of this field is that the vector starts to rotate depending on its chemical shift. And these were the three vectors that we had before. There was one vector that is exactly rotating with the speed of the rotating coordinate system, that is a on-resonance vector, and the other ones start to rotate according to their chemical shifts. And we detect the length of these vectors, and you see that the rotation is follows a trigonometric function. And Fourier transform then gives us the frequencies of the rotations. So the red one has a frequency of zero because it's on resonance, the blue one has a positive frequency, and the green one has a negative frequency. So what I would like to do now is to show you, by way of example, how Fourier transform does that. How does Fourier transform work? You may have heard this in other lectures, and it's a repetition, or you may hear this first time, but this is now what we do with another presentation. So the second presentation, da bin ich schon. The second presentation is Prinzip der Fourier-Transformation, Principle of Fourier-Transformation. Is there a shortcut for going in full build modus? Does anybody know in PDF the shortcut for going into full build modus? Nee. Steuerung L. Okay, so introduction into Fourier transform. You can imagine that you can multiply trigonometric functions. So, for example, if you multiply cosine omega t with cosine omega t, you get cosine square omega t, and the integral of this function is greater zero. The integral of cosine omega t is zero in this region because you have as much positive as you have negative. And similarly, the square of sine omega t times sine omega t sine square omega t is a function that is greater than zero. The integral of the function is greater than zero. Now, these are non-decaying integrals of trigonometric functions. But you can also imagine that if you multiply cosine 2 omega t times cosine omega t and integrate this over time, that you see that this integral vanishes, because this is the same as this, and so forth and so forth. Or sine omega 2 omega t times sine omega t is a vanishing function, or cosine omega t times sine omega t. So products of trigonometric functions can be greater, the integral of products of two trigonometric functions can be greater than zero or can be zero. This is, by way of inspection, this is absolutely clear and kind of trivial. Now, we had seen that if we have three oscillations of three spins with different chemical shifts, then we get such an FID. I mean, they sum up. We detect the sum of the three rotating vectors. And the sum of these three rotating vectors gives such a oscillation, sum of oscillations, where we don't see the frequency up front, because it is there are three frequencies in there. Actually, this has been constructed by looking at three frequencies. And what we have not yet discussed, but we're going to discuss later today, is there's also some damping function on the FID. So the magnetization decays. It doesn't rotate forever. Now, if you look closer just into this part, you zoom in, then you see there is kind of one oscillation that I see, and there's another slower oscillation here somehow. And if you further zoom in here, then you see, there is this oscillation that was this one, is now zoomed in this one, and then there's another oscillation. So if you look in and you detect this and digitize this, you can also see by eye that there are three oscillations. But if we go back, here you don't see the three oscillations, you're not so sure. You see, it's more than one oscillation. This is the only thing you can say. So then, let's apply Fourier transform. And how we do that, I re-explain in a minute. But we have this FID that we have detected by NMR. It is stored in the spectrometer, in the computer. And we multiply this by 2 pi times t. This is such a function. And then we get this FID. So if we multiply this with that, this with this one, we get this FID. And if we integrate over time, then this is zero. There's as much positive as negative. Okay? It's a vanishing function. We apply with 2 times 2 pi t. It's a vanishing function. Still, we have more as much above zero as below. We apply by 19 times 2 pi t. It's a vanishing function. The integral is a vanishing function. We multiply by 20 times 2 pi t, and we get the integral is 3. So one of the frequencies that is in this FID is 20. Okay? Now we try to project out the second of the 3 frequencies. So we multiply with 21 times 2 times 2 pi t. It's again 0. By 400. This is still an oscillation. And then we get 2. And if we multiply by 401, we get 0. And 399, we get 0. So then we have the second frequency. The first was 20, the second was 400. The third, and then there is still a third component. This is yet a faster frequency. So we multiply by 6,000, and if we do that, then we get the integral of the experimental FIT times a synthetic FID with a frequency of 6,000 gives 4. So I have 3 signals, one with a frequency of 20 and an amplitude of 3. This was the integral. One with 400, integral of 2, and one with a frequency of 6,000 hertz, integral 4. And these are, by way of construction, these are the 3 frequencies that are in this FID. So this FID contains 3 frequencies, 20, 400, and 6,000. And Fourier transform projects out these 3 frequencies. And if I take, you saw this, if I take a frequency of 19, I get 0. If I take a frequency of 21, I get 0. It just is a non-vanishing integral if I exactly hit the frequency. Okay? Do you have questions? Questions? Is it clear? Have you had an introduction to Fourier transform before in lectures? Yes. No. So it's not. I mean, I never had that when I studied. So for me, it was a big thing to understand. But if the concept is established, then it's fine. Gut, then we stop this one here. And so we are still in the topic of 1D NMR. And I briefly want to touch on the topic of phase correction. The mathematics of phase correction is detailed in the script. In this grayish part. So this is script number 2, and there are gray parts in the script that are a little more mathematical. In the Klausur, in the exam, we will not go into too mathematical stuff. You see, look into previous exams so you have a good idea of what kind of questions you get. But for the ones that want to know it in detail, how it works mathematically, it is described here. So I don't go into the mathematical stuff too much, but I just give you an idea of what is phase correction. Why do you need phase correction? You need phase correction in every spectroscopy. And there are two components to phase correction. There is a zeroth order phase correction, and a first order phase correction. And I tell you where they come from. So the white coordinate system is the rotating frame coordinate system. And the rotating frame coordinate system lies here and rotates with 600 megahertz. Now you apply a pulse. You apply a 90 degree pulse from direction X, and the rotating frame coordinate system and the pulse they define x direction. Which means that after this 90 degree pulse, the vector lies along, should be a white color. The vector lies in the minus y direction in the rotating frame. Then I detect and the detection frame coordinate system. Can have a relative phase, so the x, y, minus x, minus y of the detection system can have a phase relative to the excitation system. So they don't have to necessarily align. If I draw this in a circle, then the white coordinate system is the excitation, but an excitation screen. I have an excitation coordinate system and the detection coordinate system lies here. So the vector that lies in the minus y direction in the excitation coordinate system lies at 45 degrees in the detection system. And so this phase difference is frequency independent. It is always 45 degrees. And the zeros order phase correction is then minus phi. Everybody who has worked with 1D NMR has always seen that when one has to apply a phase correction, and there are two components, and this is the first one. This applies a frequency-independent first zero-order phase correction, and that shifts the two coordinate systems of excitation and detection to be overlapping. Now you could say, why don't you adjust this once and forever in the spectrometer? I mean, you just set this and have it. This is not, you can't do that, because for every experiment and every fine-tuning of a sample, this zero-order phase correction changes. So it is always new, so you cannot set this once and forever. Yeah? So the first-order phase correction comes from something different, and that's a little more difficult or more exciting or whatever. Frequency dependent, and we again need three spins. for the sake of simplicity, they all have intensities 1, same intensity, and their spectrum looks like this. And we position our rotating frame frequency, our on-resonance frequency, on this one. So this is our on-resonance frequency. So the yellow one has a plus 200 hertz frequency for the sake of the argument. This one has a minus 300 hertz frequency. And now we apply a pulse. And up to now, this time I applied from Y. Up to now we thought, or we have treated the pulse as very, very short, indefinitely short. But that's, of course, not the case. A 90-degree pulse on a spectrometer that we use is about 10 microseconds long. So let's dissect the 90-degree pulse. Let's assume the 90-degree pulse is 9 microseconds. That's easier to calculate. And now I dissect the 90-degree pulse in 9 pulses of 1 microsecond. Yeah, and then let's see what happens. So after 1 microsecond, my vectors have a small tip angle, relative to the Z field. So they now have a component, just draw this for the yellow vector, that is transverse, and they have a component that is still along Z. Yeah? And if I draw this picture after 2 microseconds, then they're further down. And the transverse component increases. Now, what does the transverse component do? It actually rotates according to its chemical shift. So after, with a very fast, infinitively short pulse, the pulse works like this. With a pulse that takes 9 microseconds, you tilt this vector, and the moment you have magnetization in the XY plane, it starts to rotate. So basically the trajectory of this vector goes like this. It's not strictly in the XY plane, but it actually goes like this. So the trajectory for one vector, something like in the end this has a position in the xy plane. So one calls this evolution a posh name for development, evolution, Entwicklung, evolution of chemical shift. During the pulse. Okay. So after the 90-degree pulse, the red vector is on resonance, so it has not evolved. The yellow vector has evolved with plus 200 hertz. It's here. And the blue vector has evolved with minus 300 hertz. Can you see that? So for the phase correction, I have to do nothing for this vector. I have to multiply this vector by minus 200 hertz, and I have to multiply this vector with plus 300 hertz to get them aligned. So it is. So the phase correction is phase times omega I, and phase times blue omega I. So it's a linear phase dependent first order phase correction. Practically, so what you do in the software that you use to analyze NMR, you have an FID, you Fourier transform, and then you get such a spectrum. Which has a line that is not purely absorptive, but is absorptive and dispersive. We come to this in a minute. Then you apply, then you say, I define a peak that is for the phase correction my reference point. That's called the pivot, or in English, pivot. But it comes from French, it's the pivot. So then I apply phase correction zeros order, and that makes this pure absorptive. You see, negative part becomes larger and larger the more distant it is from this peak. Yeah? So I still have here dispersive negative parts. So this guy now looks like this, has a small dispersive part. And this guy has a larger dispersive part. This is pure absorptive, has no negative part. And now I apply phase correction first order. And the phase correction first order is zero here and is at its maximum at the other part of the spectrum. If I were to apply the pivot here, then my first order phase correction would look like this. So I can apply the pivot wherever I want to. But here, I apply it on the left side of the spectrum. And then after phase correction, first order. I get three absorptive lines. Do you have questions for this? Okay, dann mache ich mal weiter. One more point to Fourier transform. So we had our two detectors. And the two detectors are digitized the evolution of these vectors in the XY plane. So the Y detector sees a cosine modulated function. And the X detector sees a sine modulated function. Now, that is without relaxation. So with relaxation, these two functions decay. So they go like this. And we get as the signal S of t, we had this before, we get the sum of all the peaks. We always used three, but it can be thousands. So n is the number of non-equivalent NMR active nuclei times e to the power I omega I t times e to the power minus small t divided by t2 of I. So the decay function is a simple exponential decay. And in principle, every NMR active nucleus can have a different t2 time, and that leads to this decay. Okay? Now, what are the Fourier transforms of these various functions? The Fourier transform of cosine omega I t gives two frequencies, sinc functions at minus omega and plus omega, and the intensities, if the intensity here is 1, then the intensities here is 1/2 and 1/2. Why does the cosine function give two peaks instead of one? Cosine is an even function. So for an even function, f of x equals f of minus x. So the value of the function is identical for plus and minus x, and that means you cannot differentiate between positive and negative frequencies because it always gives the same same value. So it's an even function, cosine. The Fourier transform of sine omega I t gives two peaks. At plus 1 over 2 times I, and at minus 1 over 2 times I, plus omega minus omega. And this is because the sine function is an odd function. F of x equals minus f of minus x. So this peak is at x, this peak is at minus x, and they have the same absolute value but an opposite sign. So the sine function is an odd function, and so you get two frequencies but with a minus in it. Where the I comes from, I don't discuss. You just accept this. Now, if I make the sum of, if I generate a complex number out of cosine plus I sine omega t, then the Fourier transform of this function is a single peak, plus omega. And somehow we can also, by way of construction, see this. If we have these two informations, then we can sum this up, and then only this peak stays. And that is for a vector that has a positive rotation frequency. A vector that has a negative rotation frequency, this guy would be up and this guy would be down. And then this peak stays in the sum. Okay, so the Fourier transform of a function E, of a complex function, is a single frequency. Now, the Fourier transform of the function e to the power minus t divided by t2 is such a NMR signal. It's called a Lorentzian line. And the width of this line at half height that's called gamma, capital gamma at half height, the width of this is 1 over pi times t2. So this nice line that we see in NMR comes from the relaxation. Else it would be a single peak, a spike, one frequency. So now I first introduce two more terms, and then I discuss the consequences of such a line on detecting signals. So there is something that's called absorptive signal. And that's such a signal. Every part of the signal is positive. And if you make the first derivative of this signal, if you make the first derivative of the signal, you see that the Steigung, that the gradient is steep here and it becomes small at this point, is zero here, and then the gradient goes negative. So if you form the first derivative of an absorptive signal, you come to a dispersive signal. where this point here is omega, is the chemical shift. Here the gradient is zero, becomes negative, and the integral over a dispersive signal is zero, and the integral over an absorptive signal is one, or normalized to the number of protons. So in NMR, we plot our signals in the absorption mode, and EPR plots signals in dispersive mode. The line widths in EPR are very, very broad, and then you can determine better the zeroth frequency, because the gradient here is steepest. So if you want to determine very precisely this position, you want to have at this position the gradient around the curve steepest. Here, the determination of this position is a little odd. It's not so good because the gradient is not steep. Okay, so but this is just these are terms. We need them later, and you have heard them, and they come back in all spectroscopies, dispersive, absorptive signals, and so forth and so forth. Now, we talk about the effect of T2 relaxation on line widths. So we have the oscillation, and we can have a very slow relaxation. Relaxation is described by 1 over minus t to the minus t divided by t2. If we have a slow relaxation, then t2 is long. And t2 is long for small molecules. Why this is the case, we discuss later in January at the end of the lecture. And then I basically get a slowly decaying FID. And the Fourier transform gives a sharp line. At the other extreme, if I have a fast relaxing system, then my T2 is short. That happens with large molecules. This gives me a fast relaxing FID, and that leads to a broad signal. The integral over the signal from here to here is 1, and the integral over the broad signal is also 1. But the max intensity. Is of course different. Can you imagine how come that if you have fast relaxation in the time domain, so this is time domain, this is frequency domain. Can you imagine that a long oscillating signal gives a sharp peak, a short oscillating signal gives a broad peak? It has again something to do with these pairs. But I try to explain. Let's assume this is my signal that has a frequency of 20. And I want to differentiate this of a signal that has a frequency of 21. So the difference between these two signals is 1 hertz. In order to see this difference, I have to be able to detect the peak that oscillates with 20 hertz and the peak that oscillates with 21 hertz. So I have to, in order to differentiate this, I have to see signal that has oscillated for 1 hertz, which means 1 second, at least. Then it is one rotation. The difference is one period. So if I have two peaks that are close by, in order to see them, I have to have a long-living signal. If I have a short-living signal, I cannot differentiate between 20 and 21 hertz. And that leads to a broad peak. So the faster in the time domain a peak decays, the broader the peak becomes. NMR lifetimes are of the order of 1 second. Electron transition lifetimes, you have discussed this with Wachtfeitel and Heilemann and others, they live for nanoseconds. Fluorescent peaks are, compared to NMR peaks, very broad because they live for extremely short period of time. NMR live for very long time, and so peaks can, in principle, be very sharp. Understood? Questions? Okay. Now I want to introduce into 2D NMR. And we have done this before, but maybe we have done this before in organic chemistry, one, but I redo this. And so, the concept of 2D works on the aspect that the FID is digitized. So when we have the oscillation, let's assume this oscillates between 1 and minus 1, and it's a cosine function, then we We take data points. We decharge the decharge the capacity at finite points. And the distance between the points is called the dwell time, Verweilzeit, and the dwell time equals one of the spectral widths. So the spectral width for 10 ppm at 14.4 Tesla was 6,000 hertz. So 1 over 6,000 hertz is the frequency at which you have to digitize your FID. If somebody has a calculator, he, she could do me a favor and calculate 1 over 6,000 hertz. Then I can and can write it down. Kann das mal einer machen? Habt ihr einen Taschenrechner? Oder du? Du machst, super. Every 167 microseconds, you take a point. Now, the way I have constructed this FID, the points that will be stored in the computer form a vector that has points in the time domain, so for example 2k, and the vector will be 1, 0.70 -0.7 -1 -0.70 +0.71. This is a cosine function that is digitized at 0 degree, 45 degree, 90 degree, 135 degrees, 180 degrees. Yeah. So the cosine of 45 degrees. Is 0.7. And such an FID I have detected in an experiment where I have applied 90 degree pulse and have taken data points. So I get this signal of time. And that exactly gives this FID that I now digitize at discrete time points. I don't look at the FID the entire time. I don't record it the entire time, but I record it at digitized points. Now, up came the idea that one could do an experiment actually with two times. And since there are two times, I call them T1 and T2. And I make a first experiment where I set T1 equals 0. And that must give exactly the same result as before. So this is this FID. I detect the points. My vector for T1 equals 0 has 2k points and starts with 1, 0.7, 0, minus 0.7, minus 1, minus 0.7, 0, and so forth. Now I can repeat the experiment. For T1 equals 1/12 time, then I still have the same oscillation, but the first data point I record is here. So then my signal, or my vector, for T1 equals 12 time, 2 points, and starts at 0.7, 0, minus 0.7, minus 1, minus 0.7, 0, 0.7, and so forth. I can repeat this same thing after having waited with the first acquisition for 2 12 times. So it's the same oscillation, but the first data point I record is the third data point on the line. So this gives me FID, whose first point starts with 0, minus 0.7, minus 1, minus 0.7, 0, 0.7, 1. So now I have stored that data in a computer. And just for fun, I can write a little C program that tells me to extract out of these 2k times 2k data points. I have repeated this experiment 2048 times. So I have a two-dimension, I have numbers stored in the computer. And the numbers I have stored in the computer are 2k times 2k. And I write a computer program that takes the first data point, skips 2047, takes the 2049th data point. So this is the first data point, this is the 2049th data point, this is the 4099th data point. So I write a program that skips, takes the first and this one and this one. And I read out the numbers that I have there. And this is 1, 0.7, 0, and by way of construction, the next one would be minus 0.7, minus 1. It's exactly the same information that I have in there. Now the T2 time is a real time, is a real physical time. The T1 time is a virtual time. This time I have generated by repeating the same experiment 2k times with slightly varying parameters. But I can Fourier transform my data along this direction. This is then a signal of T1 and omega 2. And I can Fourier transform my data along this direction by taking the first data point, skipping 247 data points, taking the next data point. And then I get a signal that is a signal of omega 1 and T2. So I can apply a two-dimensional Fourier transformation. And I can play this trick indefinitely, and then I have an n-dimensional data set. So now, the cheat of this thing is that this kind of experiment explains to you how you can generate a second virtual time, but this doesn't contain any new data. It's useless, the experiment. And you can see you could also have generated this data set out of the first data set. You just measure it once for 4K data points, and you generate all these additional FIDs just in the computer. It contains no information. So this is not why you do 2D. So now comes the question of why do you do 2D experiments? And there's a little philosophical description of schematics of 2D experiments introduced by Richard Ernst, who invented 2D, or he didn't invent 2D. I say that story because it's important, but you probably have heard it, but then I repeat it, how 2DFT was invented. So the scheme, the first 2D scheme that was put on a table, on a blackboard, something like this. Jean Genet at a conference in Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia, and Richard Ernst was sitting in the conference, took notes, immediately understood the validity of this concept, that this would be great, and waited for Jean Genet to actually not only put this on the blackboard and propose that as a 2D, as a general principle of how to introduce a second dimension in any spectroscopy that you can think of, but also conduct this experiment and see that it really works. And Jean Genet, after 2 years, hadn't done that. And Richard Ernst then, after 2 years, said to his PhD student or postdoc, I don't know, let's do the experiment. And that was at the time where Fourier transform and doing all of this was painful with these cards. So all this computer information was on cards. So it was very, very painful to do all of this. And then they conducted the first 2D experiment, and then they published. But ever since that point, Richard Ernst, whenever he gave a talk about 2D, everywhere he said, it's not my idea. I never thought about the idea. It is Jean Genet's idea. I simply executed an idea that I heard at the conference on August 8th, 19-something, in this place in Yugoslavia. Richard Ernst got the Nobel Prize. But I think part of his reputation was his honesty, his real clear honesty. It's not my idea, somebody else's idea. But there's a difference between having an idea and never doing it and doing it. And it's also not the only contribution that Ernst did to the field. And Ernst also saw that this FTIR is generally applicable to all the fields. So FTIR, Bredenberg stuff, 2D FTIR is based on this principle. Magnetic resonance imaging is based on the principle, and Ernst, in his very first paper, opened all of this. He said this will be applicable to all these sorts of things. So he actually knew all of this. Richard Ernst, one of the least disputed Nobel Prizes that have been awarded. Anyway, so Ernst also in this first paper, when he did this, made sort of a philosophical scheme of correlation spectroscopy in any kind of spectroscopy. So the any kind of 2D has a preparation phase. Evolution phase. A mixing phase and a detection. And what you can do is, and you can extend this to ND, then you just add more mixing steps and more T3s, T4s, T5s, T6s. And what this scheme is all about is that you have a specific spin state or specific spectroscopic state in the first time. Then you explore some interaction between these spectroscopic states in NMR between the spins. And then you detect it at a second time. And the mixing that you can do in NMR on transferring magnetization from one spin to another one is either by J coupling or by dipolar coupling. Or by a chemical reaction. Now, J coupling, in ethanol we have the methyl group that is a triplet and has a 7 hertz coupling. And we have the methylene group that is a quartet and has a 7 hertz coupling. So the CH2 group and the CH3 group have a pairwise coupling, which is the J coupling that they share. So Ernst thought there must be a way of transferring the J coupling from the one state to the other state. There must be. I don't know how, but there must be. And these are experiments that are called COSY or TOXY. For proton-proton transfer, or HSQC and HMBC, for example, for proton-carbon transfer. They transfer the spin state of one spin to the other one by exploiting J-coupling. Dipolar coupling, this is magnetic dipole interaction through space. So this sees two protons if they are close in distance. And that is being exploited in NOSI spectra or ROSI spectra. So if two spins are close in state, their dipoles interfere. How they do this is complicated, but we'll get to this at the end of the lecture. And that is a second way on how you can transfer magnetization from one spin to the other one. And there is chemical reactions. You could imagine you have a reaction that takes place at equilibrium. So you have some state A, some state B, and they are in equilibrium. They interconvert. And if the rate of interconversion is fine, then you can look at the spin at the first state in T1, then wait for a time. During this time, state A has converted into state B, and then you detect state B. And since an equilibrium reaction, you also see the back reaction. And that's the first reaction that is the first experiment we're going to discuss in detail next time. And that is also the NOSI spectrum. And all of these spectra have first been introduced by Richard Ernst on small model compounds, stupid stuff like dipromopropanic acid or so. Nobody cares, but he was not interested in any properties of molecules. He was interested in inventing these methods. And always the first application to biomolecules, to proteins or peptides, was done by Kurt Wüthrich. And Kurt Wüthrich then, 10 years after Richard Ernst, also received the Nobel Prize. So Kurt Wüthrich has also a tremendous role in this, because you can imagine if you can do things on deprome propionic acid, that is fine, but to some extent, who cares? Who cares? I mean, how am I interested, after all, in diprom propionic acid? Probably not. But Kurt Wüthrich could show that you can solve structures of proteins using the methods that Ernst has invented and do other things, and then more people got excited. So also this is an important step to do. I mean, Jenner just writes down some theoretical stuff. He's a theoretical physics guy, couldn't care less. Ernst says, I take the most stupid molecule, but I show that it works. And then Wüthrich says, I take the most complicated molecule and show what I can take, get out of this most complicated molecule. So all of these steps are important for a method, but they also focus on different aspects, you know. Okay. So such a scheme will generate a signal that is modulated by these two T2 times. So it has a general form of e to the power I omega I T1 times T divided T2. Now comes a term that comes from the mixing. How efficient is the mixing? It's not modulated by time, because the mix time is not a function, it's not varied in time, it's a fixed time. It's always the same times e to the power omega I e t2 times t small 2 t2. So this is always this function, and the Fourier transform gives the signal of two frequencies, and that leads to a 2D presentation where you have at least two spins, because at least two have to interact, and you have a diagonal and diagonal peaks. The diagonal peaks have the property that nu1 equals nu2. And you have cross peaks and the frequency of this one is actually comes to resonance in the omega 1 dimension at capital omega A, and in the omega 2 dimension at capital omega B. So it's a cross peak. And the cross peak is modulated, it's proportional to the length and efficiency of the mixing. And from quantification of this cross peak intensity, I get out information about the interaction. And that is, I get information out of the size of the J coupling or the size of the dipolar coupling. And from there, I get information about distances. But that is 2D. And with this, it's 10:45. And I thank you for your attention. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. Tschüss.